Wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Rolling Stone Magazine. Reading from the June 2025 edition of Rolling Stone Magazine. And from Random Notes, strong genes, a family tree bears 2 good apples and more great TV. The Better Sister marks the first major work of Olivia and Elizabeth Milch, daughters of Deadwood legend David. Officially, Prime Video's new series, The Better Sister, is an adaptation of the 2019 novel by Alafair Burke about a pair of estranged siblings, here played by Jessica Biel and Elizabeth Banks, reuniting when one's husband is murdered. But it's also a way for the show's creator, Olivia Milch, to work through the family dynamics with her own sister, Elizabeth Milch, a Better Sister producer, and their dad, David Milch, the brilliant but troubled mind behind the all-time classic TV dramas Deadwood and NYPD Blue. In the story, the father of Beale's Chloe and Banks, Nikki, was a drunk who sobered up before younger daughter Chloe was old enough to be aware of the worst of his behavior. Chloe has grown up to be a celebrated journalist and activist, raising her sister's son, while Nikki is a recovering addict. Similarly, David Milch suffered multiple addictions, including heroin and gambling, but got sober by the time Olivia was 10, while his daughter Elizabeth was 15. The girls' personalities, along with her brother Ben, who, like Elizabeth, witnessed his father's addiction, formed accordingly. Olivia, age 36, is a firecracker. She makes her presence felt entering the Better Sister set in Queens, asking each member of the crew what's happening with them, enthusing about their work. Elizabeth is friendly and warm, but not as boisterous. During the most tumultuous part of her childhood, she observes, "It probably felt useful for me to be quiet and watchful, to know what a given day would be like and how best to fit into it." Olivia's earliest childhood memories are being on the set of NYPD Blue, a self-described, very proud Nepo baby. She's brought pieces of her father's past into the show, hiring Regina Corrado, who wrote for Deadwood, and David's inscrutable follow-up series, John from Cincinnati, as her co-show runner. The supporting cast includes 3 Deadwood alums: Kim Dickens as the cop assigned to the murder, Michael Harney as Choi's loyal doorman, and Keone Young as a private investigator. There are other subtler links, like a scene where Nikki imagines meeting with their late father in a bar, modeled on and quoting from an NYPD scene where Detective Andy Sipowicz dreamed of a similar encounter with his dead son. The entire production is laden with Milch family Easter eggs. The walls of Chloe's luxurious apartment are lined with paintings, staggering good, says Beale, by Olivia and Elizabeth's mother, Rita. Production designer Ford Wheeler unwittingly designed Nikki's pool house to resemble a guest house David and Rita used to have. Also a coincidence, in the set for AA meetings, Wheeler hung a sign that reads, "Keep your side of the street clean." One of the most often said phrases in our home growing up, Olivia says. But some Milchian hallmarks Olivia was not keen to tap. David Milch sets were chaotic by nature. Scripts for individual scenes often weren't completed until hours before they were filmed. This slowed the process so much that Dickens remembers looking at call sheets that say, "Day 17 of 11 and TBD on script pages. The Better Sister production was both more organized and more relaxed. Growing up with that environment, Olivia says, sometimes you think, maybe I don't want to replicate that. She also knows that at least part of the reason her father, who has been battling Alzheimer's for the past decade, got away with his unpredictable behavior was, to put it quite bluntly, he was a man. By contrast, she created a set with a super feminine energy, as Beale describes it. You just felt like you were in your mom's kitchen. Amid the intensity of both the murder mystery and their shared past, Nikki and Chloe have a vivid, complex relationship, a natural outgrowth of the women behind the show. On the last day of filming, Dickens says, Olivia stood up to thank cast and crew and could barely get out the words thanking her older sister. All she wanted to do was to make her proud. The older sister sees another parallel. Olivia and Chloe Elizabeth says, have their fixer mentality. Anything that comes up, they're both like, why don't you just let me handle it? They're 100% right, but you also want to say, as a protective older sister, or you could let other people try to do things, and who knows how it would go. But why, Olivia asks, grinning, would we ever want to find out? And now for a featured article on police reform. The battle for the soul of the Los Angeles Police Department, a revolutionary program that united former gang cops and Watts residents to bring safety to the projects. But can reform last? Above all, he remembers the boots the cops wore when they kicked down the door of his mom's apartment. They yanked him out of bed and a deep sleep. 12 gang cops in riot gear searched in the room for a tall, for his age, 10-year-old named Tion Tisdale. Where is it? They yelled, manhandling Tion until they realized he was only a child. In his terror and confusion, Tion stared at their jacked boots, thinking, how did I not hear those on the stairs? 16 years later, that question still haunts him when he wakes in a soft panic at 5 a.m. The cop who led that raid in 2008 is also haunted. No one wins when you execute a no-knock warrant. But that night, all of us lost, says L.A. Police Department Senior Lead Officer John Coughlin, a cop so feared that in much of Watts they called him the Boogeyman. He busted 3 generations of bounty hunter bloods in as many decades. For years, any cop-connected shooting in Watts was ascribed to Coughlin by the streets of the Southeast Sector, in particular by the residents of Nickerson Gardens, a 55-acre stand of low-slung slabs known as the Nick, where there's no getting in or out without running a gauntlet of gangbangers. No matter that Tion was a stardust child whose early brilliance on the basketball court earned him safe harbor from the Bloods, that he grew to become such a playground god that his travel ball coach, Andre Miller, an NBA assist champ, called him the greatest prospect to come from Watts. Tion's soul was forever kinked by that Coughlin-led raid at 5 a.m. When he came down and saw his mom handcuffed in the yard, I watched all the innocence go out of the kid, says Coughlin, who at age 55 and balding, has softened a bit from those clenched fist days in the aughts. It stuck with me forever, though I hope I've made it up to him. God knows, I spent like 20 years trying. It was clear at the scene that Tion's mom, Ty Lynn, knew nothing of the crack found in her flat. It belonged to a family friend who stopped by sometimes. Coughlin knew he had a mess on his hands. Ty Lynn was a certified nursing attendant to the elderly and disabled. But because it was her name on the apartment lease, he felt he had no choice. His team booked her on possession with intent. She spent 2 nights in county lockup before her brother bailed her out. But as they hauled her off, she looked Coughlin in the eye. Please don't put my little boy through the system. Coughlin took Tion to a donut shop, bought him breakfast and some chocolate milk, then dropped him off at his uncle's house. By week's end, Tion was back with his mom, obsessed with never setting 1 foot wrong lest Coughlin and his riot cops came banging back up his steps. Coughlin looked up my uncles and my aunts, said Tion. When he came around, everyone scattered like he was the devil with a pitchfork. 3 years passed. Tion grew and grew, a kid of 13 destroying high school juniors in AAU tourneys around town. Then one day in the summer of 2011, a cop stopped by the Tisdale apartment to make his mother Ty Lynn an offer. I'll pay Tion's way to Catholic school and fund him straight through high school. All I ask is he keep a 3.0 grade average and be a leader for other kids in my program. Ty Lynn heard him out, then told her son he was going, period. They warily thanked the cop, who showed himself out to begin making arrangements for Tion's transfer. That cop was John Coughlin, and his program, Operation Progress, would change almost everyone it touched, including Tion. It plucked kids by the hundreds from the projects in Watts in L.A., granted them tuition-paid private educations, then sent them to top-tier colleges around the country on full-ride scholarships. It would surround those kids with tutors and mentors, lavish them with shopping sprees and paid internships. It would partner with billionaires and nonprofits to lift teens and their younger siblings out of squalor and slowly but surely begin to empty the pond of future Bloods and Crips. But the most salient thing Coughlin did in 2011 was say yes to Amata Tigridis. Tigridis, a black police sergeant and unstoppable rock star in the Los Angeles Police Department, had been tasked with setting up four new squads to undertake the impossible in Watts, to make peace with its residents, build faith with its leaders, and break the gang's stronghold on its corners. Those new units, to be known as the Community Safety Partnership, or CSP, were the brainchild of a pair of ex-combatants, the newly named Police Chief Charlie Beck, and a firebrand opponent of gang cops and chiefs, the social justice titan Connie Rice. After years of warfare in open court, Rice, an attorney and civil rights activist, had spent decades suing men like Beck for their blue grip suppression of the poor. They came to a hard-won truth. Shock and awe policing did not work. Far from making Los Angeles safe, it wrecked war without end between cops and gangs and turned Watts and Compton into domestic kill zones, forever blotting the lives of the kid raised there. As the administrative officer of the CSP, Tigridis was recruiting 40 cops from hundreds of applicants on the LA police force, chosen for their street sense and hunger for change, and enticed with a pay hike and a promotion to come on board. They would be something possibly never seen before in an American police force, part social worker, part peacekeeper, and part apologist for the department, taking responsibility for some of the indefensible wrongs inflicted by gang cops over the years. Officer John Coughlin sat with Officer Amata Tigridis, listened to her sales pitch, then asked her why she wanted Watt's most hated gang cop, him, to become her first big hire. I told him, because you're a badass, and because the gangs fear you. They'll know we're not going away, said Tigridis, who has since risen from sergeant to deputy chief in the L.A. Police Department. But the bigger reason was Operation Progress. I wanted his program to be the model for my cops. John Coughlin thought it over, weighed the raise and title upgrade, and then accepted her offer with one provision. I don't apologize for anyone, he said flatly. And another thing, this shit will never work. John Coughlin is a man of many powers, but prophecy isn't among them. The CSP has blown past its founder's dreams, evolving from a tactical hand grenade to a transformational power in Los Angeles. It has more than doubled in size, become a standalone bureau of the LA Police Department, and help repair the department's pitch-black reputation in Watts, South Central, and East Los Angeles. In just its first 6 years, it saved the taxpayers of Los Angeles an estimated $100 million in major crimes prevented, as reported by a team of researchers at UCLA. It helped radically reduce the death toll in Watts, raise the solved murder rate in that area to 100% between 2023 and 2024, and took back parks and playgrounds from gangs, giving families green space to picnic and play Little League games. It was no one's intent to invent the future of policing when CSP was launched in 2011, but that is precisely what its founders have done, built a new breed of cop and retooled the social contract between a community and the officers who protect it. It's premised in the notion that safety is a covenant between two parties, the cops who patrol the riskiest streets and the residents who trust and respect those cops enough to help them keep the peace. That is where CSP comes in. It deploys its cops less as foot patrolmen than as problem solvers. They get street lights fixed, abandoned cars towed, and gang graffiti scrubbed. They find jobs for strapped parents, treatments for first offenders, and vocational education for at-risk teens. They sit gang leaders down and strike a pact. They'll ignore petty drug deals and public drinking on weekends in exchange for those men leaving their weapons at home. Above all, they recruit every kid they can find for CSP rec teams and youth clubs. Volunteer-based outfits, like the Police Athletic League, have been around for decades, offering after-school programs, tutoring, and camps in major cities across the country. But Los Angeles is actually paying CSP cops to run cheer squads and reading groups. The reward for all their labors, a powerful rapport with the residents of Watts, and countless kids rerouted from the gangs and the carceral system. But for all its successes, CSP has had to fight for its life from the day its boots hit the ground. It faced years of fuck yous from the residents of Watts, who told those cops where to stick their fine intentions. It built faith with gang leaders only to be backstabbed by gang cops from its own precincts. It survived a backstage plot to gut its methods and mission by a newly named police chief in 2018. Only the last gasp heroics of its co-founder, Rice, saved CSP from the chopping block and saved South Los Angeles from becoming Sinaloa, a place governed by its homegrown cartels. Connie Rice is that rarest American treasure, a public intellectual who serves the public by bending power systems to her will. Years before she dreamt up CSP, she sued Los Angeles on behalf of poor school kids and low-wage riders of city buses. She and her partners proved beyond all doubt that Los Angeles' spending was grossly biased and won billions of dollars to build schools in South L.A. and expand surface transit throughout the city. Over the first three decades of a dreadnought career, 10 of those years spent as a litigator for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, she sued anyone and everyone in charge of institutions that trampled the rights of the underserved. After $10 billion were won in such cases, Rice narrowed her focus to that first of all freedoms, the right not to be murdered by your neighbors. If you're trapped in a project run by Grape Street Crips, then none of your other rights count for squat, Rice says. And so Rice, who's still regal at age 70, and still working as a nonprofit lawyer, set her sights on the Los Angeles Police Department. For 30 years, the department had waged a blood-soaked war against the Black and Hispanic gangs of L.A. It tried building a blue wall around the city's south side, hoping by siege to surround the gangsters and scoop up any daft enough to try to leave. But gangs are a virus, a pathogen that overwhelms its host, then poisons those trying to contain it. Over that 30-year span beginning in the 1970s, the city of Los Angeles spent $25 billion to reduce the gang's powers. Its yield? A six-fold increase in the number of gangs, with membership rising past 100,000 and roughly 8,000 unsolved murders in the city's Southeast Division alone. It is impossible to overstate the strength of those gangs and the terror they inflicted on working families. They raped the sisters of boys who refused to join their set. they sent welcome wagon crews to rob and beat families moving into the hood. They volleyed gunshots and garbage cans at police cruisers responding to 9/11 calls. Inevitably, the bug then bit the department, turning gang squads into gangs with badges. The most famous was the CRASH, which stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, the unit in the Rampart Division, assigned to the neighborhoods west of downtown L.A. Its cops tortured and ripped off countless gang members when it wasn't jacking kilos of coke from the evidence room. Years before the CRASH scandal broke in 1997, Rice was suing the force for goon squad tactics. To take but one of those suits and its reach, Rice learned in the early 1990s that the department's canine teams were maiming 80% of the people they busted and sending almost half to the hospital. Rice's team bundled together 40 such cases, got hold of a videotape cops filmed for their amusement, which was a reel of bloody victims they called dog biscuits, and won not only cash restitution, but also a revamp of that unit. The L.A. Police Department transferred the handlers who taught those dogs to maul, put new trainers in charge of the squad, and created an outfit that 30 years later is still a benchmark for other squads. But for all her courthouse coups, lawyer Connie Rice did not make a dent in the L.A. Department's mindset. The model for its gang squads was search and destroy. The model for its SWAT team was shock and awe, she says. They were stuck on stupid during plantation policing and somehow expecting a different outcome. By the end of the 1990s, the feds had seen enough. The U.S. Justice Department won a consent decree forcing a radical rebuild of the L.A. Police Department. In response, city leaders hired former NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton to run the force and give him carte blanche to clean house. Bratton had left New York with a complex brand. He was a fierce apostle of broken windows policing, which put people in jail for petty infractions like public drinking and turnstile hopping in the subways. But he also introduced the CompStat system of tracking and reducing crime. In 3 years, murders fell by around half in New York City. Other violent crimes also declined, and Bratton became the face of the new police chief, a technocrat who brought quants to law enforcement. His first act in Los Angeles was to demand the resignation of every department leader from captain on up. He hired back the ones who respected his vision of reform and pushed the old boy cronies to retire. He tapped a famed defense lawyer as deputy chief and charged him with bringing his roughly 9,000 cops into compliance with the Justice Department consent decree. But the best thing that Bratton did in his 7-year stint as L.A. police chief was to persuade Connie Rice to come inside the tent as conciliaire. He asked Rice to run his Rampart probe after 4 prior attempts merely scratched the surface. It took years, but Connie Rice finally cracked the code by coaxing Rampart cops to spill their guts. In roundtable talks, their full humanity emerged, their fatigue at fighting gangsters to a draw, and their guilt for how that fight traduced them. I was too stupid to understand that search and destroy doesn't just destroy a community, Rice recalls one captain telling her. It destroys yourself. That captain, Charlie Beck, became Rice's thought partner as he climbed the ranks. In his opening act as a Rampart boss, Beck restored a tarnished asset, MacArthur Park, to its former luster. Once the emerald of the Westlake section, MacArthur Park had become a shooting gallery for gangbangers, sex workers, and addicts. Before he sent his cops in, Beck enlisted everyone in the area, business owners, residents, pastors, and yes, gangsters, to help him reclaim that space. He recruited the Forestry Service to trim trees so he could install security cameras. He enlisted Public Works to help de-clean the park of syringes and used condoms, and persuaded the L.A. Philharmonic Orchestra to stage free concerts. He promised parkgoers foot patrols and new streetlights. The community signed on, and the city followed suit, funding a concert pavilion and a metro station, then restoring the spring-fed lake. When the renovation was done in 2005, Connie Rice walked the park with a reporter. They saw couples on paddleboard boats, children playing soccer at 9 in the evening, and picnic tables packed with families. Without firing a single gunshot, Beck had pulled the park back from the brink and given Rice her template for Watts. Go into its gang-run projects, offer the shot callers something of value, and ask for their assistance making the streets safer for school kids and grandmas, their own included. Connie Rice wrote her Blue Ribbon Report on Rampart, but used it to platform then-Commander Beck and his heal and build vision of policing. On the strength of that report, Beck was named the new chief when Bratton moved on amicably in 2009. But Beck had barely furnished his office when Connie Rice burst in on him that summer. A Korean woman had been robbed and nearly gang-raped on her move-in day in the Jordan Down project in Watts. "This madness stops today," Rice screamed before Beck calmed her down. "You and I are going to fix this together," he said. "What do you have in mind?" Rice ticked off her list. A detachment of 50 cops, 5 sergeants, and a captain to protect the terrorized tenants of Watts projects. It took Beck 2 years to forge Rice's model with his civic partners, the housing authority which owned those projects and failed to protect its tenants from the gangs, the city-run gang reduction and youth development agency known as GRYD, whose remit was to shrink LA gangs and their violence by winning at-risk kids with a raft of programs, and the reluctant union for the city's cops, whom Rice had spent a decade fighting in court. With those sign-offs, Rice and Beck chose the core of CSP, picking officers who had a moral awakening after joining the LA police force. Those officers got weeks of training from GRYD, learning to be protectors, not oppressors in Watts, and to let the small stuff slide. The nickel and dime crack sales, the tickets for open containers, none of that mattered anymore. Their task now was forging rapport with people who loathed and feared them, going door to door and introducing themselves, even to the gangsters on the corner. But before his cops were deployed in Watts, Chief Beck dispatched Connie Rice to meet the folks who mattered most, to ask for their blessing. "In 2010, I met the matriarchs of the Grape Street Crips, knowing we had no shot without their say-so," Rice says. Sitting with 5 women in their 50s and 60s, Rice led with a concession. "I'm nuts for even asking you to work with cops who've killed your sons and husbands, but there's a new chief in town. He wants to try something different, and we all know the old rules don't apply. The kids these days, they're shooting everyone in sight. Your grandkids might be next." Those women, most of whom are dead now, assailed her as a near white bitch who had some nerve. Rice listened, then reminded them all that she spent decades crushing cops in court. In the end, they told Rice they'd think about it. A couple days passed. Rice got a call. "On behalf of our babies, we'll meet with those cops. But for your sake, they best not be lying." Training Day with John Coughlin started out blue and brilliant, with a faint zest of gunplay on an April morning. We sip coffee in his cruiser when 10 cops run past, bolting out of a southeast station to give chase to a gang member who jacked a driver. 10-1, it's a PJ Crip," says Coughlin, belting in. "They're likely to boost cars for their smash and grabs, swarm a store on Rodeo, clean it out, and then dump the car wherever." Half an hour later, we're circling Figueroa Street, or as the Hoover criminals call it, Figahoa. At 9 in the morning, it's a symphony of sorrows. Girls in bras and string thongs totter on spikes, twerking for the schmoes just off to work from the chicken rendering plants. From bodega doorways, teens in hoodies glare, one hand on the bulge behind their belt. The pimps, says John Coughlin, hawking up the word like a horsefly, is caught in his thorax. Each of those pricks has a six-pack of girls, makes 300 large a year doing nothing. Coughlin shows me Figueroa because it's not his circus. His three-mile strip of human trafficking is the only L.A. hot zone without a dedicated CSP unit. That makes Coughlin mad enough to spit. In other sectors ravaged by gang tyranny, Watts, South Central, Newton, East L.A., CSP has established a beachhead and says it has slashed violent crime by roughly half. There's magic in what it does, but no mystery whatsoever. First, its research partner, the national nonprofit Urban Peace Institute, dispatches a team to canvass the community about its wants, fears, and needs. Armed with that data and funding sign-off from the city council, CSP embeds 10 cops and a sergeant in a hot zone division for a minimum of 5 years. Before they hit the streets, though, they liaise with their local partners, the OGs called gang interventionists. You may have heard of GIs and what they do, but whatever you heard is likely wrong. These are men of a certain age who spent decades in gangs and then made a moral U-turn in the joint. Some have murders on their sheets, others armed assaults. But what all of them have in spades is gravitas. The best are legends in the hood with street names like Twin and Taco. In 2007, they were recruited by GRYD, LA's then newly formed civilian gang unit. Over months of role-play instruction at GRYD school for aspiring GIs, they were taught to broker peace between hothead gangs who were shooting up the streets of Southeast Sector. Back when we got started, there were wars jumping off where one shooting turned into 12 shootings, said Skip Townsend, a former Rolling 20 blood since the 1980s and a charter member of GRYD's GI program since its 27 launch. Then we came in, squashed the rumors and escalation, and brought the shooters in to talk. Those sit-downs with the crews accomplished several goods at once. They ruled out the gangsters who didn't do the shooting, thus sparing the blameless from getting got. They scuttled wild gossip at the funeral of the deceased, so their crew didn't ride out seeking vengeance. And they let us remind them boys that no one's earning when bodies are falling left and right, says Townsend. On the ride over to Watts, John Coughlin recounts his own transformation. It began in the late 1990s when he and his partner came upon an execution in progress. Several bounty hunter bloods were killing a fellow blood on the first floor of a low-rise unit. Two other bloods were posted outside. They spotted the two cops and opened fire. When the shooting stopped, two bloods were dead, one by the hands of the gang and one by cops. Aside from nightmares and a partial loss of hearing, John Coughlin won't discuss the fallout of that shooting. The only person he cleaved to, his father back in Boston, suggested he use this incident as a catalyst to enact change in Watts. The two of them started Operation Progress as a tiny nonprofit raising money to support exceptional kids who are struggling with college costs. Then, 8 years later, Coughlin was the first cop on the scene when a 15-year-old was cut down in crossfire. Devon Harris, mortally wounded, would die 3 days later after life support measures were withdrawn. He was such a righteous kid and so damn young, says John Coughlin, who mistook Harris for a tween at the time. This one cut me deeper than all the rest. We exit the 105 interstate and suddenly we're in Watts. A dank haze overspreads the day. To our right, Imperial Courts. To our left, the Nick. Half a mile north, Jordan Downs. Those three projects, officially housing around 5,000 souls, but probably double or triple that number in actual headcount, are each unofficially run by a gang. In the Nick, it's Bounty Hunters. In Imperial, it's PJ Crips. Jordan Downs is run by Grape Street Crips. But a curious thing is happening on this Wednesday in the Nick. No one's working the avenues or the storefronts. Grandmas come and go, walking obstinate dogs who stop to browse the bushes. Obelisk 10 flower boxes, chatting with neighbors over fences. You'd never know this grid was a free-fire zone before CSP and the GIs came in. 16 murders a year pre-CSP, down to just 6, on average, per the Los Angeles Police Department's South Bureau Division. Here and there, bloods lean against cars, smoking something pungent and drinking beer. Both are grounds for a ticket, and years ago, dares to passing cops. John Coughlin stops his car but doesn't get out. He nods in greeting, asks the gangsters about their morning, and reminds one that he's got a job for him, a good gig driving tractor trailers. "You're too old for this shit, D. You got kids in school," he says. "Give my guy a call. He'll hook you up." D, a squat brawler in his drowsy 30s, gives a side-eye smirk. "Come on, Coughlin. You know how this game go," he drawls. "You gonna chase me? Your kid gonna chase my kid." "Suit yourself," says Coughlin, and pulls off slowly. I ask him about the petty crimes we just witnessed and the restraint he displayed. What exactly is the job of CSP, and where does the policing come in? "That's the job," Coughlin says, "letting the small stuff slide so we can come down hard on the big stuff, the murderers, the break-ins, the domestics we'd never hear about if we didn't build relationships with these people." He walks me through the protocols CSP established before it sent its officers into Watts. Stop the stop and frisk, a tactic Bratton endorsed as police chief. Replace it with stop and chat and get to know everyone on your beat. Focus less on crime than the problems that create it, especially with respect to school-age kids. Become their peewee coach or their reading tutor. Take them out to Popeyes for heart-to-hearts. And when violent crimes occur, go arrest the doer, then return and ask his folks what they need. Cash or food assistance, a job training slot, an after-school program. "That training," says Coughlin, "was the last mile of his change, though adopting it cost him many pains." His CSP overboss, police captain Phil Tigrides, then the future spouse of Amita Tigrides, dragged him to Watts Gang Task Force meeting in 2010, hosted by Councilwoman Janice Hahn. There, several dozens of Watts leaders, pastors, activists, parents, and OGs, dumped decades of grievances on those LA cops. "There was so much pain and so much anger that all I could do was take it," says Tigrides, a legendary gang cop from the department's South Bureau who had undergone a midlife transformation. As a captain of a station that had seen 5 bosses in as many years, he did something never heard of before in Watts or anywhere else. He stood up and apologized for his department. Not once in a perfunctory, "sorry for all that," but every time his officers crossed the line. "It was brutal," says Donnie Joubert, an OG blood who helped broker LA's famous gang truce of 1992 and then went on to found the Watts Gang Task Force in 2005. "Practically everyone in that room had been put down in the dirt and either framed or robbed by undercovers. But Phil kept his promise that he would stay for 5 years and get rid of all the cops who did us wrong." Tigrides, who retired in 2019, did those things and a good deal more. With his sergeant, Imada, who later became his wife, he sent cops to failing grade schools in Watts to read to the second and third graders. In one school, 99th Street Elementary, test scores jumped from bottom quartiles to the top in 2010, according to Tigrides. But that wasn't his intent. Rather, he hoped to recruit those children as change agents with their parents. "I thought if I could get the moms and grandmas to trust us, they would call us with their problems," says Tigrides. "And once we helped them out, they would tell the other moms. and then we'd start getting tips before crimes happened. That, in a nutshell, is CSP policing. It's called the Community Safety Partnership because both sides have to work at it, says Rice. You can't protect a community that won't protect itself. The mothers of those school kids did call CSP, telling them of pistols hidden in bushes and older sons preparing for first kills. We first thought CSP couldn't be trusted. They just want control over us through our kids, says Kathy Wooten, a mom who rose to power as an interventionist after she lost two sons to murder. But I said, if they can save our babies with our help, it would be the best thing that ever happened to our community. The clincher for Wooten was meeting Amita Tingrides, who's a mother besides a great cop. Tips poured in on cops' personal phones, some from GIs on the street. Over the first 3 years of CSP's lifespan, there were only two gangsters killed in the NIC, down from eight in the previous three. And as the murder rate plunged, solved murders spiked. The clearance rate in Watts in 2023 and 2024 hit 100%, an unimaginable statistic pre-CSP. We saw a beautiful change from hook and book to serve and protect, says Joe Bear. Together we helped shut down the killing, and damn if those gangsters didn't bring their nephews to Operation Progress. The majority in Watts now support the program, and their kids are excelling. But put a gun to Officer Johnny Coughlin's head, and he'll tell you straight out. Those 3 years were hell on him. If drinking on the job had been legal back then, Coughlin says, I would have been in rehab every Friday. Coughlin's been such an active cop on the street, meeting force with force. So when word got out that he had joined the department's Peace Corps, gangsters tried him every way they could. They clowned him to his face and spat curses from the corner, threatening the grade schoolers that he had mentored. I couldn't even nod at my Operation Progress kids without putting their lives at risk, Coughlin says. That much Coughlin expected, though it took everything he had to stand down when he had already busted heads. The wounds that cut closer were the ones he didn't see coming. Some of the cops in our sector called us hugga thugs, he says. They hated what we were doing and went out of their way to show it. At night when Coughlin and his colleagues were home, Los Angeles Police Department gang squads descended on the Nick or Jordan Downs and cracked skulls for small infractions. Every time we'd build a little trust with the gang leaders, the narcotics division officers would come and sweep up hoppers for a couple of rocks, says John Coughlin's partner, Eric Ortiz. Contempt for CSP went across the board. You had a community that sees white cops the same, coming from Orange County and treating the residents like they're all of them are gangsters and drug dealers, says Phil Tingrides. He had cops who spent decades in a shooting war with gangs and who viewed CSP partners as softies at best, sellouts and traitors at worst. He had commanders bashing him at cop sat meetings for refusing to arrest for small infractions. I told them, I'm not taking food off someone's table when I'm trying to build relationships, says Tingrides. For that, he got drug outside by a superior officer who screamed, I know what you're doing and it's bullshit. But Tingrides didn't budge. Beck, the new police chief in LA, had his back. Moreover, our violent crimes were dropping like crazy. The job was hell on the cops' families as well. They rarely had days off. I led a running club for kids, drove them to horseback lessons, and coached their football team, said Officer Ortiz. But when you show up every Saturday to teach a kid to swim, you're telling his folks you're committed to their kid's future. And when you fortify that message by tending to parents' needs too, getting dad a side gig at the housing authority, finding their colicky infant a pediatrician, you stop being a cop and become a guardian, their through line to a safer, stabler life. Keeblin Marks, a baker and father of four in Imperial Courts, sent all of his kids through Operation Progress. And then John Coughlin brought him in as a mentor. I've gone camping and deep sea fishing with OP and spent so much time with my kids that it made me a better man and a father, Mark says. By the end of those 3 years, word began to filter out. CSP was a smash success in Watts. Someone told the Obamas about this brave new model. They invited both its leaders, Imada Tingrides, the administrator of the four units, and Phil Tingrides, her husband and boss, to the White House. The couple sat on camera in the First Lady's box while the president extolled them in his 2015 State of the Union address before Congress. Los Angeles Magazine put Imada Tingrides on its list of 10 most influential women. Governing Magazine named the couple among its public officials of the year. On the Tingrides watch, gun violence had dropped by almost half, Phil Tingrides says, and in year two of operation, there are exactly zero murders in Watts' most lethal projects. Cities like Chicago and New York called, seeking their guidance, creating units. They were lauded by Watts' leaders and by Chief Beck. He bumped Imada Tingrides to lieutenant and Phil Tingrides to deputy chief in 2016. After years of derision from their fellow cops, the Tingrides have been anointed the faces of the new department, one built on the values they espoused. Every day I put on the uniform now, I've got a chance to change the world for the better, says the new CSP boss, Officer Bill Brockaway, a 30-year veteran of the police department. I begin and end each day here telling my cops I love them. That's how different this police bureau is. In the summer of 2018, Chief Beck retired after an extraordinary 9-year run. Alas, his successor was exactly the sort of hire Connie Rice had been dreading. An old guard enforcer, as she puts it, named Mike Moore, who hailed from the San Fernando Valley. The Valley, as it's known, is to South L.A. what Staten Island is to Manhattan, a cheek-by-jowl enclave of white flight grievance that tends to secede from L.A. in the early aughts. It is where, says Rice, white cops exchanged call signs like hashtag NKNNHI, short for niggers killing niggers, no humans involved, on dashboard computers in the police cars. Connie Rice, who claims to have ears all over the department, says Mike Moore's buddies were taking bets on how fast he would end CSP. Chief Moore denies he had any intention of eliminating CSP, calling the assertion entirely false, and notes that in fact he expanded it during his tenure. My vision was for CSP to strengthen its fidelity to its original mission, Moore says, and serve as a model for best practices across the department. But others involved with the program dispute Moore's versions of events. He didn't respect or understand Beck's relationship-based policing, says a civilian power broker who knew both police chiefs. Chief Moore resented us for getting more resources and attentions than his cops from the Valley did, says Phil Tingrides. Chief Moore categorically rejects both claims. As Connie Rice puts it more bluntly, this chief, who gaslights better than Trump, had no time for our health and safety model. It threatens the authority of old-line cops, especially ones from the Valley. When I reached out to Chief Moore in Tennessee, where he now consults with the Nashville Police Department, Moore acknowledged being dissatisfied with the leadership of CSP, but declined to say why or name names. Within weeks of taking the job, though, he confirms he called Phil Tingrides. He said, I'm pulling you out of South Bureau, where I had oversight of CSP, to run the traffic division, says Tingrides. Moore says CSP wasn't technically under Tingrides' command by that time, and the move was part of a larger department reorganization. But Tingrides maintains that Chief Moore's motive was to kill off CSP. With both Phil and Imada Tingrides out of the way, Imada had by then taken a role with the L.A. Police Department's Detective Bureau, which came with a title bump to captain. Chief Mall installed CSP bosses who he says were best suited to the mission. Connie Rice claims their goals were very different. Chief Moore's clown car captains made it known to our cops that he was going to roll up CSP within months, says Connie Rice. Worse, according to Jojo Burr of the Watts Gang Task Force, the new chief gave no agency at all to the Watts 3 projects. If they thought we wouldn't notice that Phil was gone, they must have been out of their mind, says Joe Bear. This whole community loved the Tangredis. They gave us our voice, and we damn sure used it. Members of the community made their displeasure known. Chief Moore calls that clamor expected but short-lived. Connie Rice, meanwhile, says she laid a spike strip down in front of the new police chief. She raised $500,000 to run an independent study conducted by researchers at UCLA on CSP's impact in Watts. That study bought CSP a year's reprieve. When its findings were officially released in May 2020, all doubt was erased about the power of CSP to reduce crime and promote healing in hot zone sectors. CSP saves dozens of violent crimes, including murders, and tens of millions of dollars every year, and that's just in those three Watt developments, says Georgia Leap, a gang anthropologist at UCLA who authored the study. Its effects were so profound, we called on the city to expand it and to mainstream its methods in the department. Though the local press bannered Leap's conclusions, the praise fell on deaf ears in the department. Leap says she briefed Chief Moore several times on her findings, yet he stashed copies of the study in unopened cartons in the office of an LAPD commander. Moore disputes this, claiming the study was distributed to all command staff and its findings were integrated into our strategic planning. Then, not long after the study dropped, George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis. L.A. simmered for a week before exploding. From Long Beach to Fairfax, stores burned and glass shattered. Marchers shut down freeways and intersections. City cops turned a bad weekend to a bad month, beating down the peaceful and the lawless alike and volleying rubber bullets into crowds. It's not like I didn't make mistakes in addressing the unrest, says Chief Moore, but we did the best we could and demonstrated resilience to the values we swore to uphold. But then the looters headed north, swarming the swank shops at the indoor-outdoor mall, The Grove. That last week in May, Connie Rice got a flurry of phone calls from the billionaires who really run L.A. Each of them asked the same question of her. Do we have to get rid of Moore to save the city? I told them to hang on, says Rice. I'd go see him and have an answer for them quickly. Rice booked a face-to-face with Chief Moore that week. I told him paint blank, your head's on the chopping block, says Rice, who ended her consultancy with the department, but still have a ton of juice with city leaders. When I leave this meeting, I'm going straight to the mayor if I don't hear what I need to hear. Chief Moore asked her what she wanted, and she laid it out. A standalone bureau for CSP, its expansion in the police department footprint, and oh yes, the immediate appointment of Amata Tangredis as its citywide leader. What? Promote a captain to deputy chief? Remembers Moore, scoffing. Is that what I hear you saying? Chief Moore admits he initially questioned Amata's promotion, but he eventually granted Rice her ask. Tangredis was appointed special deputy chief. CSP became a separate bureau, and the suite of CSP sites jumped from 8 to 11 with more planned. But Rice, ever the skeptic, hedged her bets. Did we prove that you can change policing from command and control to fuel engagement? Yes, we did, she says. Did we prove you can treat pandemic violence by partnering with the gangs and the folks they harmed? Yes, we did. But it took a team of unicorns to pull this off, Rice notes, starting with Charlie Beck. Where Chief Bratton was a reformer, Chief Beck was a transformer, and you get one of those per lifetime if you're lucky. Last year, Chief Moore retired from his post after 6 years. Karen Bass, the current mayor, took 8 months to choose Moore's successor, Jim McDonnell, a Bratton disciple who helped remake the force before taking the top job in Long Beach in 2010. McDonnell comes across as an admirer of CSP if not an evangelist. In a phone call, McConnell lauded its astounding impact on crime and said he hoped the motto would catch on as chiefs throughout the nation see the value that it brings. But McConnell hedged when asked about his plans to grow it, citing nationwide departures of uniformed cops following the George Floyd murder. Under Chief Bratton, the department had more than 9,100 cops. It's currently around 8,700. My biggest challenge, Chief McConnell says, is bringing the best and brightest recruits into the academy. That's especially difficult in the face of 2020, but he hopes we'll start to see more young people wanting to re-engage by being part of the difference. On my last night in town, Officer John Coughlin drops me off at a grade school, St. Albert the Great, in Compton. It's as drab and charmless as the church it's named for, until I step inside. The gym is a hive of organized bedlam, 50 or 60 children running basketball drills while laughing and talking mess in outdoor voices. Across campus, 15 girls hone a dance routine, a synchronized step from a Stomp Wars show or something that looks a lot like it. Down a long hall is a youth leadership council, a plenary of teens who brainstorm ideas for these Wednesday gatherings. The energy in the building is joyous and polyrhythmic. I float back to the gym to watch the drills. There, I'm greeted by a well-built man with a build so precise it could solve for PI. Mark May is a founder and director of this program, the I Play, I Lead Academy. He's the former assistant principal of St. Lawrence of Brindisi, one of several Catholic schools Officer John Coughlin has partnered with through the years. We call him the Child Whisperer, Coughlin had told me while driving over. There's literally no kitsch Coach May can't fix. He's the surrogate dad to half of Watts. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.